Hello and welcome to the Majlis Ready for Your Freedom Liberties Current Affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Ready for Your Freedom Liberties media manager here in Washington, D.C. 1 year ago this week, a shadowy money launderer who funneled hundreds of millions of dollars out of Kyrgyzstan was shot dead in a contract-style killing in Istanbul Cafe. I am talking about no other than Erkan Saymati, who in the months leading up to his murder had secretly provided Arif Yarıl with troves of financial documents. What those documents revealed was a massive smuggling scheme tied to the upper echelons of Kyrgyz Customs Service and its deputy chief, political kingmaker Rahimbek Matrimov. The investigation, which conducted in collaboration with the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, KULUP, and Belinkat, shook the political landscape of Kyrgyzstan, triggering anti-corruption protests that have contributed to the spectacular fall of the government following last month's elections. Now, on the anniversary of Saymati's killing, Arif Yarıl and its partners have just published a new investigation based on leaked reports from the Turkish murder proof, which makes a series of new chilling revelations about the scheme and the state of corruption in Kyrgyzstan. Today, I'm here with the authors of the project from Bishkek, Viktor Iskender, co-founder of Club News, Ilya Lazuski, the editor of Organized Crime Reporting Project, joining us from Europe, along with Carl Schrick, Ready for Your Freedom Liberties Enterprise editor, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Your Freedom Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us on this important conversation. So, I'm kind of not clear about who's who in terms of the project process. So, Ilya, let me start with you. Certainly, our topic is the new revelations. But just to refresh our memories, tell us in few words about the whole thing before we get into this latest report.
Sure. So, as you said, the reason we are so interested in Erkan Saymati is because he provided Arif Yarıl's Radio Azatik, which joined us in KLUP, in this project, with hundreds of documents that showed how he laundered hundreds of millions of dollars out of Kyrgyzstan. And based on his testimony, his conversations with reporters, and especially the documents he provided, that led our whole team to a big story about basically an underground smuggling empire being run in Kyrgyzstan by a secretive family, and to Rahimbek Matrimov, as you mentioned, the former deputy chief of customs there, who both enabled the corruption that made this possible and profited from it. So, and then, of course, when Saymati was killed, just before our initial big batch of stories on this project was published, that made clear how dangerous this whole situation was, and also, of course, made us all the more determined to publish and get his words and his testimony out there. So that's why a year, you know, we've continued working and revealing more and more about the Matrimov family, about their involvement in politics, about their continued grip over the customs in Kyrgyzstan. And of course, the fact that our main source was murdered is a very relevant fact, and that's why we pursued this latest story.
Right, right. And in part, the finding of the investigation has led to the protests, which have contributed to the fall of the government. This is what the authors claim, right?
Yes, initially, last year, after the initial batch of stories were published, there were a couple of fairly large, at least by Kyrgyz standards, protest, anti-corruption protests. Mm. You know, it's widely known in Kyrgyzstan, or widely suspected, I should say, that Rahimbek Matrimov was wealthy and that he grew wealthy through corruption. But we provided definitive evidence. This made people very angry. They came on the street. And then after the election this year, in which a political party backed by Rahimbek did very well, they got second place, and people got very angry about the result and about the fact that there were clear signs of violations, including massive vote buying. And that's really what led to the uprising, you know, and it's become a very unsettled situation there. But it was clear that the establishment was viewed as widely corrupt. And I have to say, yes, I think that is part due to our revelations that this project led to.
Yeah, I guess there is a lot to be elaborated on this aspect, especially in terms of the impact of independent journalism in Kyrgyzstan. Let's get back to this in a moment. But first, let's talk about the latest investigation. So, Carl, let me bring you in. So what triggered the latest cycle of your investigation?
Well, the investigation into Saymaiti's murder from the Turkish side, it's been an absolute, not a complete black box. There's been a few summaries from Turkish police, but there was very little information about how this investigation is actually proceeding. We know that shortly after the murder, there were four suspects that were arrested and charged, including the accused gunman. Hmm. You know, there were very scant details about them. They had links to Kyrgyzstan. They were described as Kyrgyz-born and had spent time in Syria with militant groups there. But exactly what leads Turkish police were pursuing and who might have ordered the murder was completely unclear. And so recently reporters obtained leaked records from the Turkish investigation, not a lot, but a handful. And these included the transcripts of interrogations of the suspects, of the four suspects. I think we got from all four, I think we had testimony, as well as the testimony from Saymaiti's widow. And these testimonies were all given over the course of, I'd say, 2 to 3 days following the murder. And there are two main things that jumped out at us. Number one, it was clear from the beginning that Turkish police had kind of wanted to link this to an extremist narrative or terrorism narrative, pointing out that the killers had spent time in militant camps in Syria. You know, Radio Azatik got a police official on the phone 2 days after his murder who said that the killer said they targeted him because he wasn't a Muslim. But what these documents revealed was that motive, that Saymaiti was supposedly not a Muslim, that was merely fed to, at least according to the testimony, was fed to the killers by a Syria-based militant described as an Uzbek man, nearly 30 years old, identified in the records as Adem, and we don't know his true identity. So this idea that I think OCCRP had an excellent tweet about this, you know, of all the billions of non-Muslims in the world that could be targeted, it just happened to be the source who was feeding our publications documents. Yeah. So that's the one thing. And the second thing that jumped out, because Turkish police had never identified by name the people that Saymaiti worked with, in the records, Saymaiti's widow says that Saymaiti had warned her that if anything would happen to him, the people who would be responsible would be Reinbek Matraimov and Saymaiti's employer, a cargo tycoon named Habibullah Abdulkadir. Now, of course, this is hearsay, and it's merely what she relayed to police. There's no concrete evidence of their link to the actual murder in the documents. But, you know, it does actually corroborate the things that Saymaiti told reporters before his death, namely that he had received threats and that the materials he was dealing with were very explosive and dangerous.
Hmm. And just to be clear here, Matt Raimov is denying all these, right?
Yes. This is our publications have been doing the series for nearly a year now and have never actually been able to obtain an on-the-record direct comment from Reinbek Matraimov. And for this story, just before we were going to publish, we got a comment in which he denied everything.
Mm. Okay.
Denied any links with Saymaiti or any links to his murder.
And there's another very shadowy character, Abdulkadir, right? Abdulkadir. Did he say anything after this latest revelation?
We have never got a comment from Mr. Abdulkadir, for whom Saymaiti worked. And, you know, it was the same case with this article.
Okay. So, Bektur, how these findings, the findings in the latest investigation revelation, echoed where you are in Kyrgyzstan, what the people are talking about there?
I should say that in social media, there was reaction, but it was not as active as it was last year, for example, when we published the first series of this joint investigation that we did. Because last year it was like a real shock for people, everybody had been waiting for someone to publish something like this, I guess. And it was like the top story of the year, I should say. And Saymaiti's murder was a shock to everybody. During this year, people maybe got used to, you know, the story. You know, it kind of happens with news quite often, unfortunately. You know, when people got used to the fact that, yes, Matveyevs are a corrupt family, this is kind of a fact for many people. And that's why every news series, it was a bit more difficult, to be honest, at least for us at Klopp, to get attention of people. I think there is also another reason, is that Kyrgyzstan has been going through insane political events during last month. I'm afraid that attention of people was so much distracted. But at the same time, these events would not happen, maybe, if, you know, people were not aware of the scale of corruption that was revealed in our series of investigations. So it's all linked in a very complicated manner. But at the same time, I think people started kind of forgetting about Saimaiti, this murder. It all kind of is becoming a bit of a story of the last year, you know. So that's what I was feeling. But for me, I mean, the most important part in this investigation, in the context of Kyrgyz politics, right, was, you know, that because we needed to corroborate, you know, this documents from the Turkish police, and we kind of checked them together with the statement of the commission of our parliament, and some things were kind of coinciding in these two documents. But what is really sad is that our parliament commission that is investigating the murder of Saimaiti, they kind of tried to get rid of any link with Matveyev or Abdulkadir. I'm not even sure they are mentioned at all in the document by our parliament, and which is suspicious, which probably shows, you know, how our politicians were trying to kind of avoid, you know, mentioning Matveyev in any way in the connection with this story of Saimaiti murder. And what is going on now with Matveyev is also very interesting in Kyrgyzstan. I mean, he was kind of arrested, but then he was released and put under house arrest. And now current acting president Japarov is saying that he doesn't really want to imprison Matveyev, but at the same time, he kind of tries to find the way for him to pay the money that he had stolen. And it's very confusing because we don't have it in our legal procedures. You know,
and the detention of Matveyev and then subsequent release of him, all this is kind of, you know, these developments kind of connected to what you guys have revealed in the report earlier, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty much sure, because, you know.
Yeah, so it shows that the report is still in the minds of people, also influencing their actions.
Yeah, the thing is, our series of investigations basically kind of almost destroyed the reputation of Matveyev among a significant part of the population of the country. And I think they clearly understood it, and that's why they were really mad at these publications, of course. And at the same time, you know, they really had to buy votes in order to get the second place at the parliament elections, because and they were especially worried about the northern part of the country. We analyzed, you know, the manipulation with the voting, and we understood that in one of the manipulation schemes, their party mostly obtained votes in the northern part of the country, because it seems like they understood that, especially in Bishkek and especially in the northern regions, their reputation is so low that people would probably not vote for them if not being paid, you know, or if they don't bring people from other regions. And then when new people came to power, like Japarov and, you know, Tashiev and whoever is now like leading the country, they understood that in order to calm down people after this uprising, in order to kind of make everybody happy, they started immediately declaring, you know, loudly that, oh, we're going to catch Matveyev. And it's interesting that they had to say things like this. Yeah. And I'm sure that they mostly had to say this because of our publications. They were kind of forced, you know. And then this arrest happened, which the former head of the Security Council of Kyrgyzstan said that, called it theater, you know, the way they arrested Matveyev.
Yeah, I think there is a lot to talk about in terms of the impact of this independent journalism in Kyrgyzstan, the way it's been still echoed. And Bruce, you and I kind of looking into this amazing report from outside. Did anything surprise you, Bruce, in the latest revelation of the report? I mean, we have authors here, so definitely go ahead and ask questions if you have any.
Well, yeah, I do. And, you know, I mean, I was surprised that the Turkish investigation is so opaque, but I'm kind of curious about, you know, Bekir just mentioned that they actually detained Matveyev, and, you know, and he's technically under house arrest. But it's very curious that he, without going into any details, Japarov has said he promised he's going to give back 2 billion som, you know, which is about $24 million, or something a little bit more than that. without mentioning where this money came from, why he has to give it back. I mean, they really glossed over this whole thing. So I'd be curious to know the impressions of of our guests about how they look at that, you know, that he's not confessing to anything. and it's just like, oh, he promised he'll give us some money back. What money? Where? Why does he have to give it back? Where did it come from? They just glossed right over that. You know, it's very curious. And then, of course, Japarov himself said that Matraimov had told him when they had been talking, it would seem to you could imply that it was a cordial conversation. And Matraimov said there was no use in arresting him. And I'm like, what suspect gets that kind of, gets that kind of leeway that he can say, you really don't want to arrest me, but the money is the big question. I mean, how to understand the fact that all of a sudden he has to give back more than $24 million, but they don't ever say why.
Very, very.
This is when I thought the exact same thing, and I actually thought that I had misunderstood something, because I was reading Japarov's statement and it was like, we're not going to charge him because if we do, then we won't get any money out of him. But you can't. How do you get money out of someone without finding them guilty of something? Right. So, I mean, I just don't think, as far as I know, I don't think there is a logical answer to that question out there right now. I don't know. Maybe Bechtor has some ideas, but it certainly looks like a way of essentially for Matraimov to buy his way free. I guess we'll see what happens. But I mean, if he's not being charged with anything, why is he having to pay anything at all? And how do you arrive at the amount?
Bechtor, is there anything you would like to add into this?
I mean, it's a total mess. There is no other way to explain it. And the problem with Japarov is that I think he doesn't really understand what he's talking about. I mean, he's already famous for totally contradicting himself on so many issues, We published a couple of collections of, Japarov's self-contradictions. I'm afraid the same story might happen with Matraimov's, and I'm afraid a lot is going on right now behind the scenes, these negotiations attempts, Matraimov's trying to save themselves. I'm pretty sure they are trying to find the way to kind of, not being in prison, but at the same time, they understand that just leaving them without any kind of punishment, will make people angry, because it will show that actually nothing really has changed, after the uprising. I mean, Matraimov probably might think of who they're going to support at the presidential elections, and maybe they should support Japarov. But at the same time, does Japarov need this kind of support? Because it might play really against him. But I'm sure a lot of interesting things are going on right now behind the scenes. I hope that at some point they will become public, and maybe we will uncover them. Maybe some other media will do that. But anyway, it's going to be really interesting to understand, what actually is going on right now.
Behind
the closed doors.
Yeah, Carl, just to bring back the discussion into the latest revelation, especially the Turkish police's report. I mean, are you expecting anything new to come out in terms of this proof, or that was all it is? I mean, we are not expecting any new development out of this investigation.
It's tough to predict anything. We will certainly keep our eyes on the investigation area or any developments, and of course are happy to get any leaked documents. but it's even tougher us from the outside to understand what the status of the actual investigation of Saymaiti's murder is. The Turkish police gave us no response in Reinbek Matraimov's response to reporters. He used some weird phrasing that justice had already been served in the case. If that is the case, there is certainly no public indication that these four individuals have been tried and convicted. So we really don't know what's happening. A senior Kyrgyz Interior Ministry official said over the summer that Turkey was withholding information about the investigation. To what end, we can probably only speculate. Whether Turkey is using it as a geopolitical lever to influence the Kyrgyz politics, I just don't know. So we certainly will be following the murder investigation. Regarding Matraimov's arrest and the money he's supposedly going to pay, I mean, it is absolutely bizarre when we have no idea even what specific corruption they have in mind regarding the accusations under which he was arrested. We don't even know what for. They've only said corruption. And certainly if he's merely allowed to pay back a fine and then let go, that will be a great disservice to Kyrgyz society when they won't even know for what alleged crimes he was forced to pay up.
Yeah. You know, Kyrgyzstani politics is kind of mess sometimes. So, you know, I was again looking into report when you were talking about Madrimov. So there are some very intriguing and interesting details as to how Saymati was murdered and developments leading up to his murder. I mean, who killed him, how this killing happened, the planning and execution stages of the assassination and the impact of all of this for Kyrgyzstan. So let's continue the discussion talking about this and many other questions very shortly. Here, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by from Bishkek, Bektor Iskender, co-founder of the Club News, Ilya Lazuski, the editor of the Organized Crime Reporting Project, joining us from Europe, Carl Schreck, Radio Free European Liberties Enterprise editor, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free European Liberties Central Asia Blog, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free European Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the latest phase of a year-long investigation on a multi-million corruption scandal in Kyrgyzstan. So, Ilya, let me bring you back into this investigation. So, Saymati, the guy who would help funneling all these hundreds of millions of dollars from Kyrgyzstan, gets killed in Istanbul Cafe. So, what are the stages led to his killing? Anything we could learn from the latest documents you got recently, which triggered kind of investigation?
Among the documents we received were the confessions or testimony of the alleged killer. Who described, I think as Carl mentioned, being hired to carry out the contract killing. He talked about his accomplice, who they were each promised $50,000, I believe, for the killing, to carry out the killing. He talked about arriving in Istanbul about 2 weeks prior to the killing and tracking Saymati, which is a little disturbing because that was the same time period when a reporter met with Saymati for the last time, just about that time, 2 weeks before the murder. So they, this guy did not sound like he was a very, you know, experienced operator necessarily. He said the first attempt to kill Saymati, they got cold feet and backed off. And then they called this guy, Adam, who had hired them. And he said, well, if you're going to back off, then, you know, give the money back. And they said, no, okay, we'll do it. And then they, you know, continued following him and finally did it. So, I mean, yeah, I guess my main impressions from that story, from his telling of how it was the first of all, that it, you know, he wasn't someone who knew who Saymati was really. Well, he said he personally didn't know him. He just received this order from this guy, Adam. And as Carl said, you know, it's sort of a strange scenario that this Islamist militant would hire someone to carry out a targeted murder of a specific person, quote, because he wasn't a Muslim. I mean, that's the story the Turkish police have been giving, that that was the motive for the killing. But it certainly always seemed very strange. And I think this new story mainly, I think, sheds a lot of doubt on it.
So he was expecting this to happen, is it?
Saymati, yes. He had said numerous times that he had been threatened. You know, he was difficult to be in touch with. He would sometimes disappear for a few days, then come back. He would promise to give some documents or promise to have a meeting, and then he wouldn't show up, and, you know, with no explanation. And then later, when he did give an explanation, he said he was frightened and that he was being threatened. So we already knew that at the time. And he also, of course, this story was already sort of a scary one because one of his associates had already been killed in Kyrgyzstan. This was a man who was a cash courier. He was regularly delivering money to Saymati in Istanbul, but he was flying it over from Bishkek, and it was sort of part of this big network of money launderers that Saymati had built and earlier employed on behalf, he said, of the Abdülkadir family and for the benefit, in part, of the Matraimov family. And this man, this cash courier, who was just, you know, a local taxi driver, he was found dead in the trunk of his own car. So Saymati was already frightened. He thought that people were after him. And also, as we learned from the new documents, his wife was saying to the police the same thing, that her husband was scared. He even warned her that she had been photographed. So that's, you know, another reason he was scared that he was being followed. And then the first story after his death from the police is that this was related to some kind of religious extremism. It just didn't make sense. And I think for me, this story, these documents and this story kind of put us at ease, like, okay, it all sort of makes more sense again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the attitude of Turkish police kind of interesting, and then also the subsequent report coming out of this. Carl, to continue what Ilya just has said, Ilya said that his wife, Saimat, his wife was reporting to Turkish police what was going on. So it means Turkish police was also aware of what's going on with this man. So any sense from your conversation with the sources that police was negligent about this possible incident which was about to happen, complicit? How you characterize the role of police there?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do any speculating here. What we can see based on the documents, again, this is a very just a snapshot of the materials in the case. You know, it's a handful of documents, but we did see in the documents that Saimati's widow mentioned Saimati's employer, Habibullah Abdulkadir, and that the Turkish police actually asked the gunman, the accused gunman, the killer, if he knew Habibullah Abdulkadir, to which the gunman said, no, I do not know him. So given the details in his testimony, I suspect that's correct. The killer, as Ilya correctly described him, seemed to be a very low-level, inexperienced contract killer. So Turkish police did actually ask about Habibullah Abdulkadir, according to the records. And of course, Habibullah Abdulkadir is certainly known to the Turkish government. He has significant business interests in Turkey. And as our report revealed, his main Turkish company, to which, according to the records Saimati gave us, he wired tens of millions of dollars, sent over cash couriers with money for this company, for Abdulkadir's company based in Istanbul. And in the spring of last year, Habibullah Abdulkadir's company became one of the largest donors to an anti-coronavirus campaign spearheaded by Erdogan. So certainly Habibullah Abdulkadir is not unknown to Turkish authorities. To what degree Turkish police may have followed up on this particular line of investigation, we simply don't know.
Very, very interesting. And now his wife, Saimat, his wife is in Istanbul, and in some way she is providing additional information. I'm just wondering whether she's safe there. Any thoughts?
So the information from Saimati's wife that we included in the report was based on the documents. Obviously, we made extensive efforts to corroborate the details in these records to ensure that they are indeed authentic. And that included reaching out to Saimati's widow, who did not deny their authenticity, but declined to say anything about Matreima for Abdulkadir.
So, Bektur, we are talking about this dangerous situation in which people are killed and threatened, and especially talking about Saimati and his family. And you guys are on the ground and also part of the project. How you feel this intimidation in your own life, in the life of your own colleagues who might be part of this project?
Well, first of all, we are still not revealing the names of people who contributed to this investigation from outside. And it is the first time, I think, in our history when we had to do this, and when we have to do this for such a long time, because we are genuinely worried for the safety of journalists who are doing stories. And we've had some cases when it was quite alarming, some signs. Like we described them in one of the previous stories in early October, when we published a series of stories about Matraimovs, how, journalists would be followed by some unknown men, and then they would threaten, our driver. Basically, especially if, journalists show up in the town of Karasu or anywhere where Matraimovs are especially active, it's noticed immediately, and then immediately journalists are being followed by someone. We had to take some security measures which had never existed in our history. We improved, the safety of our office, and we've come up with some new security protocols for our employees. I mean, of course, it's difficult. It's tiring. It's we need to, to from time to time to have help from a psychologist, because it's really nervous. And I mean, what also makes it quite difficult is that even those who don't work on the investigation, they kind of have to, you know, follow the same protocols, and they are worried too, of course. And but at the same time, what really motivates us to keep on doing this work is that we understand that, you know, Kyrgyzstan is one of these few countries where it is possible to see the changes. I mean, sometimes these changes maybe not the ones that we wanted to have, but in general, we kind of live in a country where, you know, it's possible to sometimes see some really unexpected U-turns, you know, in our history. Like, and the person who seems to be very powerful next year might be, you know, losing all the authority, all the power, and be imprisoned or whatever. I mean, we kind of got used to that in Kyrgyzstan. And I think the possibility to kind of, you know, to change something motivates us a lot. And that's why we don't give up. And we also feel huge support from the civil society. I mean, those of us who are here in Kyrgyzstan, we definitely understood how much more famous and respected all of us have become. Okay. I mean, all the media that worked on the investigation. You can feel it sometimes in the daily life, you know. People are really thankful to us, you know. I've met quite a lot of people who would tell me that they are thankful for the work that we are doing. And which also brings a lot of hope, you know. And we've seen how our civil society has been getting stronger and stronger every year. Yeah, and I'm really happy that in a way we maybe inspired other people also to not to be afraid, you know, to stand up against this sort of corruption or any other wrongdoing by influential and powerful people.
Yeah, it's very inspiring what you are saying. And, you know, beside these threats, sort of threats that you guys were describing, Matreimovs also made lots of kind of strange moves, what I hear, to stop the publication of this report. Anything which could be elaborated on this platform?
Yeah, so the strongest move from their side was that they filed a lawsuit against us, and they tried to get quite a lot of money from us. But what is interesting is that since August, their lawyers have been trying to postpone this process as much as possible. And I think this is also quite an interesting sign, you know, because we had some delays due to COVID, you know, when courts in Bishkek just stopped working at some point, and we had to wait until the situation with the pandemic would be a little bit better. And then in August, the court was ready for the next hearing, and it was supposed to be, I'm not sure if I'm good at English legal terms, but it was supposed to be the first hearing where actually we would, you know, start exchanging proofs. And, you know, because before that we were most of the hearings were mostly about some procedural kind of norms. And so we were kind of getting prepared to it, and then suddenly it was in the end of August, suddenly the judge was ill. And it was strange because, you know, our lawyer has checked that in the morning the judge was in the building of the court, you know. We were like, okay, you know, whatever. But then they kept on finding some other reasons to postpone this process, you know. I mean, my hypothesis is that they probably didn't want to have this hearings during the pre-election period. Also because two of the lawyers in this process from their side were candidates in Mekanim Kyrgyzstan party, the one which is heavily linked with Matreimov's. And probably it would look absurd, you know, that lawyers from their side are coming to the court and they are at the same time candidates at the parliament elections. They probably understood that it looks a bit wrong for their reputation. So that's kind of my hypothesis why they tried to find ways to postpone this whole process. So then immediately after the revolution happened, suddenly, you know, because the next hearing was appointed on the 8th of October, suddenly no one just showed up, and the court had to postpone it again. And then yesterday it was supposed to be the next hearing, and now two of the lawyers of Matreimov's didn't come, and they used this as one of the reasons why they postponed it for one more month. And I think it's probably the same reason why they're doing it now. It's similar probably to what was in August, because we again are now in the pre-election period. And probably they understand that suing us right now looks not so good, you know, for them. But then nobody understands what's going to be further. What would be the next move? What is the next step? I think they at least my impression is they are probably also quite confused, you know, about what's going on and what should they do.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's been a really good conversation. Bruce, you kind of in the background today, is there anything you would like to add here or any question you would like to ask? I'm kind of reaching to the final points. With that, we will end the conversation otherwise.
Just a couple of observations from reading the report. I thought it was interesting, and Bektor would probably be the best to answer this, but you know that they had Abdülkadir's business in Turkey was contributing to help the fight against coronavirus, but the Matraimovs had the same kind of thing going in Kyrgyzstan, which I thought was interesting. It's almost like it's a tactic or something. They also had a charitable fund that was providing money to help battle the coronavirus. And I'm also curious about this person in Syria that they keep referring to. You know, if you're an English speaker and you see the name Adem, then you'd assume this is a name. But in Central Asia, this word, and you would know this too, Muhammad, this word could just mean a person. You know, it might not be a name at all. So I was curious to know if the investigation had determined that this really was a name. You know, it's a small point, but I'm just curious because, like I said, Adam is the word that I'm more familiar with. But like I said, that just means a person. It doesn't mean it's not a name for somebody.
Yeah, just I don't know what the other colleagues would say. In Turkey, though, Bruce, Adam, the way it's written in the report, is also a name there. Turkish people use that widely. Maybe it's coming from there. I don't know. Any thoughts on that, Ilya? Carl, just jump in.
I would say, based on the actual testimony, the way in the context, it does look like it's used as a name. We don't know if it's a real name or, you know, a pseudonym, a nom de guerre. We don't know. But in the records, it is indicated as a name. Bruce, you mentioned the Matraimovs contributing, making donations to fight coronavirus in Kyrgyzstan. It wasn't only the Matraimovs. It was Abdülkadir's company as well was making anti-coronavirus donations in Kyrgyzstan as well, his cargo company, Abu Sahi.
It's interesting that suddenly they become so generous. And also, I was wondering kind of, if you guys were to do this investigation from the scratch again, would you do anything differently? It's kind of open question. Ilya, Carl, just jump in.
We'd start here so that we would have more time, I think. So there would be fewer.
I second that. More time would always be better. But I mean, you know, as any journalist knows, anytime you publish something, the second it goes live, there are always 10 things, you know, you wish you could have done better. But given the circumstances that were surrounding this report, you know, it's powerful, substantiated journalism.
Yeah. It happens in our world that we often don't take the credit that we deserve. But just here, last point for you guys to brag a little bit. Maybe it's not a good word to use here. Is there anything, any one thing, which makes you really proud of the investigation and the outcome? What would that be? Ilya, let's start with you, then Carl, then Bektor.
As Bektor mentioned, you know, we can't name everyone who's been involved, but there were a lot of, you know, young, really eager and really skilled journalists who worked on this, not a lot more than just those of us on this call. And I've been really proud to work with them and to see what their contributions have been. And I know they will continue to work to expose corruption, you know, in their country, in their countries. And it's really great that they've gotten so much out of this and learned so much out of this. And I think we all have, but, you know, it's a really great thing for Kyrgyzstan that there is this cadre of really talented and passionate people who will seek the truth. And I think that this, you know, our investigations are based on documents and facts and not on rumors. And there's a lot of rumors out there in Central Asia, but I think we are really pointing to some of the things that are at the heart of the government dysfunction and the corruption in Kyrgyzstan and other countries in the region. So I think that if there's any path forward for better politics and better life for people in the region, I think this kind of journalism is it.
Right.
And I'm just proud to be part of it.
Right. And Carl, and then Bektor.
Sorry, I had to step away for a second. Could you repeat the question?
We are just kind of a little bit bragging about ourselves, Carl, here. Yeah. I'm saying, what should be the takeaway out of all this project, out of all this year-long kind of investigation and hard work?
Yeah, I would broadly say that, you know, this is, as Ilya said, the reporting in this entire series is documented, it's substantiated, it's not rumors, but, you know, it's fact-based journalism. But to take a step back, It's, you know, the big picture is accountability.
Right.
It's government accountability. And I think I recall Bektor saying, I recall on Twitter recently saying that Jeenbekov had a real chance. He was, for a long time, you know, as pressure mounted to take action against the Matrema family over corruption allegations and strong evidence of corruption, you know, he was saying, where are the facts? Where are the facts? And this series laid out a trove of facts to follow up on and take action on, and nothing was ever done. And you can't say necessarily that that is what sealed his political fate, but he did have a chance to take the action, and he did not. And so journalism like this does give politicians the opportunity to show what government accountability can be.
Right.
And it's up to them to take it or not.
Right. Bektor, your thoughts on that?
For me, you know, this series of investigation is something that I think led to tectonic changes in our society, which probably we are not really feeling yet because it requires quite a long time. But I know there are two illustrations of what I've been especially proud about. When anti-corruption protests began last year after the first kind of round of stories was published, most people who came out to the streets were really young people who in other circumstances probably would not take part in any protest at all. But I saw the birth of the new generation of citizens of Kyrgyzstan who are not afraid of, you know, going and openly saying how they are not satisfied with the way, you know, people are governing our country and with the, you know, with how corruption is flourishing. And in a way, I think our series of stories motivated them to go and to be so brave and to stand up, you know. I think that's very important. And we will feel the consequences, the positive consequences of this, you know, awakening of new generation of civil society in the coming years. I really hope so. Another interesting illustration, this morning I was riding a taxi and there was a radio, and it was like a usual entertainment radio where you would never be expecting, you know, to hear anything about politics. They had some morning talk show, and this radio DJs, they decided to ask, to kind of conduct a poll among their listeners, what were the most important words of this year for them. And one of the leading words was Reim Million. And I was like, wow,
which refers to,
you know, that's so interesting.
Which refers to, like, Matreimov, right?
Yeah, which is like a nickname of Matreimov. Hmm. I mean, it kind of became part of the pop culture in a way. You know, people, like so many people know, like children at the school discuss Matreimov. Like, this surname has become so famous, but this is good, you know. It's really good. And I think it's definitely it is because of our series of investigations. Yeah. Because before that, you know, Matreimov was just some random person who was involved in the schemes, but he was not really widely discussed that much. But then, you know, when Radio Liberty first started writing stories about him and put a drone over his house. But then when we all joined, you know, forces together and started publishing it, it became kind of a household name, but of course in a very negative sense. And I mean, we just probably don't realize here in Kyrgyzstan what are the consequences of us publishing this. But I hope that, you know, they will really make our country so much a better place, you know, to live in.
Right. Okay, last testimony from Bruce here. I know, Bruce, you have to leave us in just 2 minutes. So in terms of the impact of this whole investigation, what would be your one or two takeaways from it?
I mean, I think our guests have summed it up. Oh, this was a bombshell, you know. I mean, really, this stuff was just kind of accepted and no one really thought about it. Mm. And, you know, these kind of figures like Ryan Beck, Matreimov were allowed to work in the shadows, you know, without really any concern about any consequences. And the investigations have changed all that. You know, they're aware, these people are aware now that somebody is looking, that it is possible to get solid information about their illegal activities. You know, it's just unfortunate the government hasn't done more about it. But, you know, like I said, it really brought this whole world of corruption out into the spotlight for everyone to get a good look at in Kyrgyzstan. And, you know, Kyrgyzstan is a place where you can do this kind of stuff. But, you know, by extension, the other Central Asian states are at least as bad, you know, as this. So it really puts a light on the whole region of just what a problem, the extent of this problem in the region, specifically in Kyrgyzstan in this case. But like I said, it's at least as bad, if not worse. worse in the neighboring states.
Right, right. No, it's really a powerful work, and I read it already twice as I was preparing for this discussion. It's really powerful work. I would just invite our listeners to read it, and it should be available on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's site, on the websites of Klub and Ilya's organization, Organized Crime Reporting Project. So please take a look into this. It's just such a powerful work. So with this, I guess we should stop here. In the meantime, we will also have another panel discussion on this report on Monday in partnership with the Carnegie Endowment, where we will dive into more details, also talking about some of the future-looking stuff in terms of corruption. So please tune in if you can. The invitation for that event can be seen on the Carnegie Endowment's events page. So with this, let me stop here. Thank you very much, Viktor Iskander, co-founder of Klub News, Ilya Lazuski, the editor of Organized Crime Reporting Project, Carl Schreck, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's enterprise editor, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you. Again, thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week. Bye-bye.